Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I'll stop the world and melt with you. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Today, we are launching what is hopefully going to become a series of podcasts within the Forward Thinking podcast.
I think full of hope is fine because we're the ones who decide. So, well, odds are good.
Decent chance.
We'll just see if it keeps interested. Happening.
Yeah.
All right, that's fair.
But here's the basic concept. It's you don't see that in sci-fi. Because there are a lot of times when we're sitting around having conversations about things that seem to us very likely to happen in the future, but the majority of science fiction depictions of the future don't realize these events.
And you guys sort of touched on this with the anti-gravity or the artificial gravity episode, rather, or the idea that, you know, in the sci-fi, you always see people walking around on spacecraft, but really, wouldn't you see a lot of people floating around most of the time?
Yeah. Oh, we talk about this a lot on the show, actually. Yeah. I mean, usually our entrance into any given topic is science fiction because that's where most of us experience the future.
Yeah. Yeah. I often experience the future, but by the time I can talk about it, it's over.
Yeah. But if you use the example of artificial gravity, there are some technologies we can talk about where we'd say, okay, there's some things we have in mind that could probably solve the artificial gravity problem just by simulating it with centripetal force or something like that.
Right.
But there are other things that we think are pretty sure bets for the future.
Yeah.
And you rarely see them in sci-fi, or at least the majority of the time you don't. And the one we wanted to talk about today is the consistency of modern speech and language. So I want to start y'all out with a quote.
All right.
Okay. So this is a quote I grabbed from the internet by Jean-Luc Picard, one Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Second best captain of the Enterprise ever.
Time to start a fight.
Ooh, yeah. All right. Geek fight already.
Well, Pike was the first, obviously.
So the captain of the Enterprise in the Next Generation once said this: "The Prime Directive is not just a set of rules. It is a philosophy, and a very correct one. History has proven again and again that whenever mankind interferes with a less developed civilization, no matter how well-intentioned that interference may be, the results are invariably disastrous."
So what's wrong with that?
Well, on one hand, he's advocating the Prime Directive, which I think is debatable.
Oh, well, fine, but that's a different episode.
That's a whole other nerd fight.
But taking completely aside the opinion of the Prime Directive as advocated in Star Trek, you notice how he sounds pretty much like how we talk today?
Except, you know, more English.
Right. Well, okay. So he has his own literary style, his own style
but
of
yes,
speaking.
But yes,
he's 300 years in the future and he's speaking like we speak.
That's true. That is true. He's using the same terminology that we use. He's using the same sentence structure, same syntax, everything along those lines. Yeah, I see that.
It's highly intelligible to us. It sounds exactly like someone like Picard would talk today.
Well, sure. You picked one of the Star Trek episodes that was highly intelligible. I could have pointed you to a few that aren't.
But there are some things that go even farther into the future where, you know, they've depicted far future civilizations that basically just speak 20th century English.
Sure. The example I pulled was Planet of the Apes. Very, you know, classic science fiction film. I'm talking about the Charlton Heston one, obviously. So in the movie, the year that the astronaut travels to, he's in suspended animation, is traveling near the speed of light for, I think, a year and a half, and lands on what he believes is to be an alien planet in what is the year 3978. But it's actually, spoiler alert, Earth. And you have this whole caste system of apes that have evolved over time. And the gorillas are like the military police, and the orangutans are the politicians, chimpanzees are the scientists. And they all speak English. They speak English that the astronaut can understand, even if it's not English. Let's assume for a moment that it's whatever other language it happens to be, but it has been translated for us, the audience, so we can understand it. The fact is the astronaut can still understand what the apes are saying.
Exactly.
So the language itself has not changed in his journey. So even if you give it the opportunity of saying, oh, well, it's just so that you can understand the story, the characters within it can understand each other. So
the divine spark exists only in simian brain.
Yeah. So what you get there is this crazy idea that these characters are able to communicate despite hundreds of years of separation between them. So here's
did you grab a Dr. Zaius line?
I did grab a Dr. Zaius line. I had to. Here it goes. You are right. I have always known about man. From the evidence, I believe his wisdom must walk hand in hand with his idiocy. His emotions must rule his brain. He must be a warlike creature who gives battle to everything around him, even himself. Touché, Dr. Zaius.
Yeah. Sounds like a particularly eloquent 20th century English
speaker.
Whereas
Charlton Heston replies with, get your dirty hands off me.
Do we have anything even farther ahead than that?
Oh, sure, yeah. If you want to look at The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, you want to talk about super into the future? So the protagonist of The Time Machine travels to the year 800-2701.
That's crazy. Now, Flag, I read that book. I thought that in the book they did speak a different language.
They do in the book.
Okay.
In the original.
Oh, this was in the film from the 1960s.
Right.
Yeah?
Okay. In the book version, the Eloi, which are the sort of a docile cattle, spoiler alert, in The Time Machine, but they are descended from humans, our
great-great-grandchildren ain't too bright.
Right. Well, half of them aren't.
Right.
The other half are the Morlocks, who are all the ones who do all the work and have been using the Eloi as cattle. Essentially, they eat the Eloi. So the Morlocks are the bad guys and the Eloi's are the good guys, more or less, kind of. Actually, there's a lot of socialist commentary in that book. So H.G. Wells, in his story, the Eloi spoke their own language that was unintelligible to the protagonist. But in the film, again, you have the Eloi and the protagonist being able to speak to one another fluently. So, but you're talking about 800,000 years into the future, and people are still speaking, 1960s era English.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why we're finding this so amusing is because all you have to do is look backward. Look back over time and see the historical evolution of English and see how it has changed dramatically just in the last 1,000 years or so, let alone 800,000 years into the future.
Yeah. Okay. So we plotted a little journey, a little literary journey for you.
Through quotation.
Uh-huh. Through quotation. So we've started with opening lines from literary works 100, 200, 400 years ago. The main thing to keep in mind, which we hinted at earlier, is that each of these is a different writer with their own literary style. So even two writers today aren't going to sound exactly alike.
Oh, obviously.
But even with that in mind, you're going to really notice the differences in a minute here.
Sure.
Okay, so the first work that we have was published in 2014. It's called Unlucky 13. It's by James Patterson and Maxine Petro. And we chose it because it is at the top of the New York Times bestseller list this week, combined digital and print nonetheless. So it's...
You mean we didn't choose it because it's your favorite book?
No. but it's a popular work within the culture, and so we thought that it would be a good one. So I'm going to quote the first two paragraphs. They're short, so I chose two. It was an ugly Monday just after noon. There had been no sign of sun so far, just a thick fog that had put the blocks to traffic around the Golden Gate. I was behind the wheel of the squad car, and Inspector Rich Conklin, my partner of many years, was in the seat beside me when Claire called my cell phone. Claire Washburn is my closest friend and also San Francisco's chief medical examiner. The call was strictly business.
All right. All right. So that's obviously modern English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nothing. I've got no qualms about it. Obviously, I mean, it was published this year, so clearly we would have a very similar style. Well, what's next?
I pulled a quote from exactly 100 years ago, not to this day, but to the year.
Right.
1914, from the short story Dracula's Guest by Bram Stoker, which I believe...
I expect you to do this in an English accent.
No, I'm not going to do it. Wouldn't it be an Irish accent?
Well, I guess technically I could do an Irish accent, and that would be just fine.
Why don't you read it, Jonathan?
Oh.
This is from the short story Dracula's Guest. I think it was originally a chapter of Dracula that was removed.
Right. Well, I'll do this. I'll do this in English because most of the characters in Dracula were actually English.
Okay.
With the exception of the title, the character from the title.
I hope you can pronounce all these words.
When we started for our drive, the sun was shining brightly on Munich, and the air was full of joyousness of early summer. Just as we were about to depart, Herr Delbruck, the maitre d'hôtel of the Quatre Saisons, where I was staying, came down bareheaded to the carriage and, after wishing me a pleasant drive, said to the coachman, still holding his hand on the handle of the carriage door, "Remember, you are back by nightfall." The sky looks bright, but there is a shiver in the north wind, and that says there may be a sudden storm. But I am sure you will not be late. Here he smiled and added, for you know what night it is.
Which, of course, everybody knows is Walpurgis Nacht.
Well, obviously.
I mean, what other night
look
could
at
it
all
have
the,
been?
All the banners that were up and down.
Yeah. Okay. So already, this is pretty similar.
Oh, sure. But I mean, there are a few cultural markers. Like in that first passage, we were talking about cell phones. There was the Golden Gate Bridge popped up.
Sure.
It was very clipped. This is a little bit more elaborate in its structure.
Yeah. You can also, I mean, one easy marker is the technological differences. They mention carriages and
certainly
coachmen and stuff. The cultural difference that I thought was interesting was it says bareheaded. Like that's a thing worth observing.
Yeah. Specifically, because a dude wasn't wearing a hat.
Right.
Right.
I mean, that would be weird back then, but normal now. And there's just this, even though it sounds pretty similar to modern English, there's a little bit less than modern cadence to the prose.
It's actually a little closer to Jean-Luc Picard. I mean, Picard spoke,
that's true.
Spoke more like a, 19th, maybe late 18th century character, but with terminology that was obviously updated.
Yes.
Yeah. But the sentence structure was much more formal. Than you would find in normal speech today.
Okay, I want to go back 100 years before that.
All right.
To 1814, where I pulled the beginning paragraph, part of the beginning paragraph of Mansfield Park by Jane Austen. Now, keep in mind, again, this is Austen's particular literary style, but we're definitely going to start getting into some strange lands here.
Oh, I'll do this one, as Jane Austen is pretty cool, and I'm a lady. About 30 years ago, Miss Maria Ward of Huntingdon, with only £7,000, had the good luck to captivate Sir Thomas Betram of Mansfield Park in the county of Northampton, and to be thereby raised to the rank of a baronet's lady, with all the comforts and consequences of a handsome house and large income. All Huntingdon exclaimed on the greatness of the match, and her uncle, the lawyer himself, allowed her to be at least £3,000 short of any equitable claim to it. She had two sisters to be benefited by her elevation, and such of their acquaintance as thought Miss Ward and Miss Frances quite as handsome as Miss Maria did not scruple to predict their marrying with almost equal advantage.
What?
That there's fancy talk.
It is fancy talk, but it's also, I mean, people, I don't know, something was happening differently back then. Sentences were happening in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yes. And syntax and structure and just the culture itself changes over time. That's really what we're getting at here. But, you know, I don't think we've gone back far enough.
Yeah. Did not scruple to predict their marrying with almost equal advantage. Well, that seems pretty normal to me.
We got to go further back. Joe, we got to go further back.
Are you going to make me read Ben Johnson?
I'm going to make you read
Ben
Johnson.
Okay. So the next one I grabbed was from 1614. That's 400 years ago this year. This is Ben Johnson's comedic play, Bartholomew Fair. I did a play here because I couldn't find the full text of a good prose work.
Well,
you're
getting to
novels
the point.
Yeah. Didn't really exist as such at that point.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
I mean,
well,
okay, but certainly not prominent in the way that.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
They weren't popularized the way that
no.
plays were at the
yeah,
time.
Plays were more likely where you're going to get a lot of prose.
Right. So this is Johnson's Bartholomew Fair, which F-A-Y-R-E.
Oh, and it's a knee slapper.
Yeah. It certainly is. It opens with the character called the stage keeper kind of giving this meta dialogue, like talking about the play that's about to happen.
Right, right.
So here we get. Gentlemen, have a little patience. They are in upon coming instantly. He that should begin the play, Master Littlewit, the proctor, has a stitch new fallen in his black silk stocking. 'Twill be drawn up ere you can tell 20. He plays one o' the arches that dwells about the hospital, and he has a very pretty part. But for the whole play, will you ha' the truth on't? O-N-T. On it? I am looking lest the poet hear me, or his man, Master Broom, behind the arras. It is like to be a very conceited, scurvy one. in plain English.
I love that you got the plain English there.
That's
it.
That's why I picked that part.
Nice.
Which this to me sounds like a bizarre mix of modern English and nonsense.
It does. It does. And then, of course, we wanted to go back further, and Joe and Lauren wanted to challenge me with a little Middle English.
Right. So by the time you get to, like, the 1300s, you are fully into Middle English, which is basically a different language. I mean, it's the predecessor to English.
Right.
Right.
It's got a lot of French in it.
Yeah, and without scholarly knowledge of how to, like, Joe or I could not read this aloud, but Jonathan, due to his specific
education. As it turns out,
education.
My degree was in Medieval and Renaissance English Literature. So please do forgive me if I do stumble at all. It has been about 20 years since I've done this.
This is the beginning of Geoffrey Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales.
Yes, the prologue. One that April with a shorter sota, the drachter march had passed to the rota, and bathed each vein sweetly cool, of which vetu enchantred is the floor. When Zephyrus eke with a sweet breath, inspired hath, actually it should be inspired hath in every hoth and heath, the tender croppers and the younger zona hath in the rammers have the coarser rona, and smaller fools mocking melodia that sleepeth all nicht with open ear, so pricketh him nature in her courages than longing folk to go on pilgrimages, and palmeres water second strongest strondas to ferne hallways couth in sundry londas, and specially from every shearer's inda of Ingolonda to Canterbury they weaned her. The holy blissful matter for the seeker that them hath hopen one that thy were seeking.
Woo! Yeah. Yeesh.
So, nice job, man. As you can probably tell.
I did one they. It should have been thy. T-H-E-Y was pronounced thy, not they. So I realized that after I said it.
We'll give it to you this time.
I got it right the second time, so.
That is not easy to do.
English speaker. And a lot of the words are spelled in a way that's similar to modern English, but they are pronounced in a very different
way.
And
we'll get into the reason for that in just a little bit.
But if you go even further back.
Yeah, say you go back from the Canterbury Tales to something like Beowulf.
Yeah, if you go to pre-Norman invasion England. So the Middle English was that French influence that came in and mixed with Old English to form Middle English, right?
Yeah.
So before the Normans decided to visit England and stay a while, the language was Old English, which comes from Old Frisian, which is also the root for Old German. So if you look at Old English and you start looking at words, the words and sentence structure look a lot more like German than they do modern English.
Yeah.
So one of the phrases, my favorite phrase from Beowulf is, and it's repeated a few times, is "That was God Knick," which means he was a good king. So obviously that gets said quite a few times. Mm-hmm. But yes, that was God Knick does not sound at all like English, but this is all technically English. And we've just seen how from, say, I don't know, around 700 AD all the way up to modern day, it has changed dramatically. So why would we not assume it would continue to do so?
Yeah, if Jean-Luc Picard is born in 2305, according to the Star Trek lore, if he's speaking in the middle of the 2300s, that should be like the difference between us and somewhere between Jane Austen and Ben Jonson.
All right, so here's the question. Now that we know that language changes over time, How can we predict what language is going to sound like in the future? I mean, how does language itself actually change?
The short answer is that nobody knows.
Shucks.
Yay! it's a really big question is the thing, and it involves genetics and the development of multiple brain structures and plasticity of the brain, also development of speech structures from the tongue to the vocal cords, the palate, all that kind of stuff. And then after that, the growth of systems of vocabulary and grammar. But there are a bunch of really cool theories out there, like research out of the University of Reading in 2008, which was done with statistical tools that are usually used in biology, indicated that languages often evolve in sudden spurts rather than steadily over time. And okay, note that those sudden spurts can take 100 years or more, but still, this is an interesting finding. They analyzed three of the world's major language groups, those being Bantu, Austronesian, and Indo-European. In all three, some third of historical language changes came on suddenly when a subculture split off from a larger population.
Okay, and so that thing you said when they came on suddenly, though it could take like 100 years, that doesn't mean they happened immediately, it just means the rate of change is not constant.
Right.
So they can slowly change and then quickly change.
Uh-huh.
And even so, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, language is one of those things that unites a people, right?
It defines a people.
Yeah. Without that common language, obviously you can't have any kind of communication whatsoever. And when you can communicate with someone, you start to psychologically identify with that person. You think, this person belongs, at least in some part, to a group that I also belong to.
Mm-hmm.
And when you encounter someone who cannot communicate with you and they are not able to have that kind of meaningful conversation in any way, then you start to think, at least on a psychological level, this person does not belong to the group to which I belong. So there are a lot of complicated issues here that kind of guide a language forming and then evolving over time.
Oh, sure. And part of it is that when a group breaks off from a larger group,
mm-hmm.
they maybe not intentionally, but certainly in a way purposefully distinguish themselves by certain language markers. You can see that in teenagers who are trying to be different from their parents or from when segments of the British came over to America, they began speaking differently.
Right. And then some populations of the British coming over to America ended up preserving their way of speech a lot more faithfully than others. So you'll often hear interesting stories about how there are pockets of populations in Appalachia, for example, that have speech patterns that are more akin to the Elizabethan patterns of speech way back when, which to me is fascinating. The idea that the proper English we are used to hearing from television and movies is not really indicative of what you would have heard in Shakespeare's time. To hear that, it might be better for you to take a trip to the mountains, the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Yeah, and even if it's not such a large-scale populational kind of thing, I mean, okay, so the exact role of all of these components of speech are definitely in debate among linguists and biologists and psychologists and anthropologists and lots of other fields of study. But, you know, it's obvious to even the casual observer that vocab and grammar do change over time and are prompted by cultural events, even if they're not this kind of break-off event. It could be a change in technology wherein new words come into the vocabulary and, you know, new sentence structures happen because internet.
Right.
yeah,
because internet's a good way of putting that,
yeah,
actually.
Or just locational changes, stuff like that. And so, I mean, the generalized theory is that the, you know, any current generation of speakers will internalize the language that they were taught, and perhaps differently than the previous generation expects them to, and also adopt new words, new structures, new sounds, and then transmit them, perhaps shoddily, to the next generation.
And it's interesting, in English, the way we generally see acceptance on a larger scale is when we have certain institutions acknowledge words as being actual words.
Oh, yeah. You always see these news stories. They add, you know, Webster's adds so-and-so to the dictionary.
Right. Or Oxford.
That's really more a PR ploy than the physical indicator that the language is.
Time to sell some dictionaries.
But exactly.
You remove that PR ploy by a couple of generations and it's now become part of the official documented record. Now you have
it does
other,
still matter. I get snarky.
But
about
there
that
are
point.
Countries like, countries like France that actively try to protect the native language and try and keep new Anglicanized words out of it.
They don't want, so there's no le selfie.
Well, they don't, they're not really pleased with le CD, for example, or CD, I should say.
Well, and in some languages, like in Japanese, for example, there's a whole separate alphabet for foreign loanwords in which you preserve the original language by foisting off these new words onto a different alphabet that makes it intrinsically other.
Right. So that's interesting.
I want to talk at an even more basic level, though, about how language changes, because it's not just these macro changes where overall vocabulary change. So we do get new words, yeah,
right.
And old words go out of style. And there's a sort of way of changing the cadence of sentences, certain ways of phrasing things go in and out of style.
Mm-hmm.
But at the micro level, even the pronunciation of the different phonemes in a language, the different units of sound can change over time.
Sure.
So the one example I want to refer to again is in English, because we're English speakers here. It was called the Great Vowel Shift, and this happened over the middle of the past millennium, so over many hundreds of years, but it's centered around probably like 14th, 15th, 16th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the process by which long vowels in English actually changed their sound. They used to sound more like they sound in a Latin pronunciation. So, for example, the letter E would sound like an A sound. So I guess if you wanted to get on Middle English Twitter and compose a tweet about a sheet, you would actually compose a tweet about a shade.
I often have.
And another example.
That's why
like
I have so many Twitter followers.
Yeah, you do have Twitter, a lot of Twitter followers.
It would be Twitter, though, because Twitter is with an I.
Yeah, that's exactly the other one. So Twitter would be Twitter, because the letter I used to be pronounced more like E. So the word mice, we say mice now, that spelled the same way in Middle English, that'd be meese.
Well, and when I did the prologue, one that April, would be what became April, because you have that I that becomes the E sound.
Wow. Hmm.
So yeah, it's amazing that this transformation happened and that linguists still are kind of wondering what exactly prompted that shift, because, you know, you thought that a lot of the changes in English pronunciation happened due to the various invasions that occurred. But that all happened. That was all, you know, pretty much over and done with that by the end of the 12th century, beginning of 13th century. So
yeah, I would guess that was printing press related, as a lot of changes in language were from the 1400s through the 1600s.
Gutenberg, you scamp.
Well, before we get to the printing press, I want to talk about the fact that, in fact, pronunciation can still change today.
Oh, yeah.
And has been observed to do so. So are there major changes in English pronunciation of vowel sounds today? Well, I actually read a really interesting article in Slate about what's called the Northern Cities vowel shift. So this is in the United States, and it was first noticed in the 1960s. And this is a subsequent vowel shift coming after the Great Vowel Shift. But this is affecting the pronunciation of short vowels rather than long vowels.
Well, you can certainly... There are enough preserved recordings that if you listen to something and you call it old-timey, it's partly because of the way people were speaking and the way they're pronouncing things. So, or even if you're watching a movie where a character is portraying someone, I think of the Hudsucker Proxy all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, anything along those lines. Well, everyone starts talking like this, you know, and it's all in that fast-paced, and it's all it's a different vowel sound than what you're used to. Mm-hmm. Even if you're in whatever part of the country the film or television or radio program was set in, it doesn't sound the same way. And people will call it, well, that's old-timey. And part of it is because we have had these smaller vowel shifts happen over time.
Right. I mean, they can just be part of the normal way that a dialect forms within it. It's a sub-dialect of a language. So you have yay, and then you have yeah, and then you have yeah.
And
I would suspect, I don't have any research on this, but that Great Northern vowel shift had to do, in fact, with television. I mean, mass media definitely has an effect on how we talk.
Yeah, it has an effect, except I don't know which way the effect would go. So if we look into the past, we say, okay, we can observe that language evolves like this, but they didn't have TV and radio and the internet. And now that we have these things, I wonder if, does that really affect the rate at which language changes? And if it does it speed it up or slow it down? I could see good arguments for both.
Well, and here's the thing, is that because we're talking about even speedy changes in language taking over a century, there's no way for us to answer that question without dramatically extending our lifespan so that we can actually observe it happen,
yeah.
Right?
Well,
these are all things that are happening generationally, uh-huh. And by the time you get to a point where you start wondering about these questions, you don't have anyone to ask.
Well, but these days we're going to have much more of a verbal record of how people spoke 100 years from now, and we'll be able to chart a lot more carefully, especially through algorithmic investigation, how exactly people were speaking at different points in time and in different areas. I'd argue that an early form of mass media, the aforementioned printing press, certainly had a very large and very quick effect on language relatively. I mean, it didn't standardize any language instantaneously, but it did condense dialects and word use specifically among populations as literacy went up. I mean, you know, chartably over the course of a couple centuries, which again, quick for
it also
language.
Standardized spelling.
Right. Right. Well, again,
thing.
Slowly, but yeah, definitely. And similarly, that the internet today is bringing written works and authorship, perhaps more importantly, to ever wider audiences. And, you know, okay, so this will definitely change language. As Joe said, it's kind of up in the air exactly how it's going to do that.
Right. Does it get everybody on the same page and keep them there better, or does it introduce more new usage faster?
Mm-hmm. Some researchers are suggesting that it's going to cause some languages to die out, while others either develop in their place or grow to dominate. There's a lot of theory that English in the next 100 years or two is going to be by far the world's dominant language. Although, okay, maybe not English the way that we understand it today, because similar to how like Creole or Yiddish developed out of combining cultures and languages, we're currently seeing a huge burst of media being presented in what's called Hinglish, which is a combination of Hindi, Punjabi, Urdu, and English spoken primarily in India, but it's important and widespread enough that some British diplomats are learning it.
India, as I understand it, has quite the population.
So yes.
That does make sense. All right, so we started this whole discussion talking about science fiction films, television series, radio programs, that sort of thing, where the characters speak more or less in modern English, and whether or not that's for the convenience of the audience is, that's a matter of debate, because that could come into it. But do we have any examples of books where that's not the case, where we have an evolution of language?
Well, certainly there are lots of small-scale examples, but I was trying to think of a book taking place in the future where the language that the characters speak is radically different. And I did come up with one example, which is A Clockwork Orange by Anthony Burgess.
Right.
So the main characters in this novel are these brutal, hyper-violent, cruel gangster thugs. And they speak in this very stylized, very highly different form of English.
Nadsat.
Yeah, they're still basically using English syntax, sort of like, as an English reader, you can make sense of it referencing a glossary.
Right, right.
But they use all kinds of slang. It's just rife with slang that we don't use today.
Do you want to do a line real quick, Jonathan?
All right, sure.
Yeah.
There was me, that is Alex, and my three Drews, as Pete, Georgie, and Dim being really Dim. We were making up our Razzoo Docs what to do with the evening. I shouldn't do all this line, because there's so many words that I would need to bleep out. I could do the, it was a milk plus mesto, and you may, oh my brothers, forgotten what these mestos are like. Things changing so scory these days, and people quick to forget. But it was a place where you could peat milk with something else in it. You could peat it with knives in it, or a synth mask, or Dremcom. Yeah. So you get a mixture of Russian slang.
Yes.
Because that's a big influence.
A lot of it comes from Russian.
A lot of it comes from Russian. Some of it is this sort of what we think of
pop culture
or techno babble kind of stuff. Because like you get the synth mesk, this kind of thing, where it's synthetic mescaline is essentially what that means. So you get these terms that are all sort of slangish, and of course the main characters are teenagers, so they speak very heavily in slang.
Right.
And some of the sentences are absolutely beautiful and poetic, but it requires you to look at that glossary like 8 times.
Right. And so I think that this slang vocabulary that Burgess uses in this novel is really great for two reasons. Number one, it actually does reflect how languages change over time with the introduction of new vocabulary and speech patterns. But number two, it actually has a role in the novel itself because, as I said, these characters are just awful, evil dudes. And the words they use help speak to the transformative psychological power of language because it's very easy to see how the very words they're saying, the gang members use these words to desensitize themselves to violence.
Sure. Well, you know, there are other examples as well. I think the interesting thing here is, like you say, in this case, it was a very calculated decision on the part of Burgess to create a language that reflects the personalities and psyches of these main characters. You do have other characters in the book who do not speak in this kind of slang. They're the adults.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But that also gives you that whole other separation as well that we were talking about earlier.
Right.
Sure. And right. And there are plenty of works that on a very small scale level will give you a couple of new words or usages of words here and there, like Grok from Stranger in a Strange Land, or Green from The Fifth Element, or Shiny from Firefly.
Oh, yeah.
but
I would rock you.
It's shiny. It's super green. So super I would argue that the technobabble is a little bit of a separate thing because it's vocab that's, you know, specifically about technology that doesn't exist. And so it's really more of a plot point, than a linguistic device most of the time.
It can be there in order to give a sense of quote unquote legitimacy to the science fiction, to make it sound more, technically advanced than what we currently have. And you have to be somewhat inventive to do that because obviously, you know, you can't just have all the same technology we have today and put it forward 1,000 years and expect people to think that that's an amazing science fiction novel.
Right. I think I totally agree with you that just having the name of a piece of technology in there that we don't have that technology today, it doesn't really represent a change in language. But it can, depending on the level to which the technobabble is incorporated into the everyday language of the characters. So, like, I'd say there's a difference between just making a one-off reference to a technology that doesn't exist and the way, for example, Facebook talk has been incorporated into the very fabric of how we discuss our social lives.
Or even the fact that we can look back in the past and what once was a version of technobabble has become an actual word now. So, for example, robot. It's not something that happens all the time. It's actually very rare when something like that happens. But when it does happen, it's interesting to see something that was taken as an innovative, you know, this is a new word, or at least a word that's being used in a new way, and it ends up being adopted worldwide. That's kind of interesting too.
Or for some terms like fridge, which comes from Frigidaire, which was a brand originally and not what the actual object was called, but has kind of morphed into that thing.
Sure.
I had no idea. I thought it came from refrigerator.
I'm pretty sure. I could be totally wrong. Am I totally wrong?
I have no idea.
I suspect you're right, but I was just making an ass out of you and me.
We'll check that, and if I'm incorrect, you'll never hear this.
Some sci-fi works actually meet us halfway, I'd say, because the future characters basically speak modern language, but the narrator may give some indication that this is just for the reader's benefit and that the characters would actually be speaking a much different language. One example I thought of was in Isaac Asimov's The Last Question. So there's the characters are speaking as it's written modern English, but there's just one part where one of the characters in this far future setting remembers that they're dealing with a computer called a Microvac. And the character remembers that the AC at the end of Microvac stood for analog computer in, quote, ancient English.
Yeah, so
it refers to the modern English of the reader, the English that you're reading the story in, as ancient English, as if that's something alien to the character.
Obviously, it would be problematic to write an entire book out of a manufactured language and say, this is what English eventually evolves into, and you need to learn it so you can read the story.
That's exactly the point I wanted to end on, which is that I'm not trying to chide sci-fi writers for not doing this more, because I think it totally makes sense why you would write stories in a modern dialect of a modern language, whatever language that is, because your readers are speaking that.
Oh, sure. Right. And it takes so much brain space or work for the writer and or the reader. I mean, you know, as much as I appreciate the weird brilliance of authors who write in that really heavy dialect, personally, I don't know about you guys, but I've never made it through a novel-length work of, like, Faulkner or Chida Mayville or Irvine Welsh.
Or even something along the lines of a completely manufactured language, something like Tolkien. You know, he was really interested in languages.
Oh, sure.
Things like Welsh, Gaelic, as well as Middle English and Old English. And
Strickland, you speak Elvish, don't you?
I may or may not have an Elvish tattoo.
I can't say that I, along similar lines, I can't say that I ever read any of the Elvish poems when I was going through Tolkien.
And it was interesting because, you know, according to some accounts of what Tolkien went through, including some of his own interviews, the whole genesis of Lord of the Rings was really the creation of a world that would allow these languages he had invented to exist. So that's, you know, it's obviously a different approach. Yeah.
Well, as nerdy as it is, if I'm correct, you will correct me if I'm wrong, I know. But I think Tolkien was not just like making up words. He was a linguistic scholar. Like he understood deeply how languages are formed, the morphological relationship between different words and how syntaxes are created. So he put in the work make these fake languages
real. Even so far
real.
As to have two separate languages for the elves who do have a separation that lasts a very long time in the span of Tolkien's
elves
work.
Elves get old. Yeah.
they stay around forever, those jerks. But, so even then with the two different, I guess you could call them races of elves cohabitating Middle Earth, they have different languages, which is very similar to what we've been talking about with populations splitting off and forming a different dialect or a completely new language from the parent language that they came from.
Right. So in the end, I just want to emphasize, I'm not saying that if a writer writes in their modern dialect for the far future, that's like stupid of them.
Just make sure you really...
Yeah, it's no different than if you were going to write something taking place in ancient Sumer and you wrote that in whatever language you write in, because
right.
that's how readers will
can
have access
the work.
To it.
Yeah, sure, so just make sure you put a sentence at the beginning saying, everyone spoke in a language that's totally not like modern English, but it's okay because I put it in modern English so you can understand it, and then we're all cool.
Or incorporate something like a Babelfish or
a universal translator
or whatever the TARDIS does.
And it just so happens to also work on the audience.
Uh-huh.
It's meta.
So what is Jean-Luc Picard really saying that we're only hearing in our modern English?
It's beautiful.
Lulzies.
What's weird is
Totes lulzies. Earl Grey.
It's actually all in French. He's just being French because he's wearing universal translator. It comes out English.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's
le lulzies.
Le lulzies. Le totes. All right. Well, that's all I've got in me for this episode. So this was interesting because it was more of an historical look at the English language, but really to kind of think, you know, it's difficult to project what a language will be like in the future. What we can say is it will likely be very different from the way it is now, at least in some form. It may be that the syntax is more or less the same, but the pronunciation is different. It could be that the pronunciation remains more or less the same, but we end up having weird syntax. It's really interesting just looking over the past and realizing how alive language really is. And that's something that if you're ever working on a science fiction novel and you want to address that in a realistic way, you got to get a little creative and figure out, first of all, how do you make it readable? But no one really knows. So really you can't make a mistake until that time finally comes around. And by that time, you're probably not going to care anymore. So anyway, interesting topic. I'm glad that you guys picked this as a series. And I look forward to exploring other kinds of things that is never really addressed in science fiction.
Our next idea is we want to do You Don't See That in Sci-Fi about the awkwardness of technology.
That'll be fun. Yeah. That'll be a fun one. Yeah, because, well, we'll save it for that episode. I don't want to spoil anything. So if you guys have any suggestions for future episodes of Forward Thinking, even if it's an episode in this series or something completely different, let us know. You can drop us a line on Twitter, Facebook, or Google+. Our handle at all three is FW Thinking. Or you can drop us an email, fwthinking@discovery.com. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.